Good afternoon. So last time we talked about sort of revisiting random testing, which I believe you had seen in sort of prior, in 3710 probably, and mentioning kind of some problems it has that if we just kind of generate test either by generating completely at random or starting with a basic test and randomly changing it, we kind of have these tests kind of over-test kind of not very useful inputs, where we're either making a change that doesn't really change how the program reads that input, and also where we're kind of excessively testing the syntax error or whatever the equivalent is for our input case. And we kind of compared this to what we typically do when we're looking at code by hand and want to test it, is that we say, well, I look at all kind of the cases the code handles by reading the code and say, I want to check all of them, make sure all of them run. And we talked about a variant of random testing where we try to take this information into account. So we measure what parts of the code actually run and use this to guide our randomized testing. And the basic idea is we have a set of kind of base tests we start with, and we make some random or pseudo-random or maybe even systematic changes to them, but we start with these base tests. And whenever we run a test and discover it runs code, a different set of code than we saw before, then we say, well, this is doing something different in the program. That might be an interesting case, and we add it to our base test, but we don't keep adding cases where the program, you know, just ran the same code that it did before. And to support this, we need to do something we didn't do in random testing. We need to actually kind of have access to the program we're running and make kind of low-level changes. But for this coverage stuff, those changes are, you know, they're not, I wouldn't say they're trivial to do, but they don't require any special knowledge of the program. All we're doing is we're just looking at the program and annotating the program to identify where there are places where we make conditional jumps, basically, or computed jumps, and adding to like a table saying, yes, this happened, and we inspect that table every time we run a test to figure out, did we discover something new here? And we mentioned that AFL is, you know, kind of an example of probably the most popular implementation of this, and also one that's been very successful in finding real security bugs, and one we'll have you use in the assignment for next week that I just revised to deal with what's actually important. And on lecture recordings, so I made an error and didn't post lecture recordings until yesterday for last Friday and Monday. That was a mistake. If the lecture recordings aren't visible the next day, please let me know. If the lecture recordings aren't there and there isn't a note about it on the schedule, I made a mistake. And I made apparently two different mistakes. I didn't upload them for Friday, and I uploaded them to the 3130 directory for Monday, which should work for some reason. Also, there's a rest assignment out. I'll do assignment Q&A. If we have any here. Nope, okay. Yes.
So Piazza's question, like, we can't just use ungraded information after we
So the question is, when we drop a student and they have submissions, what do you need to do when you fix the implementation? It is up to you what you do about submissions associated with a drop student. So whatever you feel is most convenient or justifiable, because I didn't specify in the assignment, you just need to do something that works with only safe, without the unsafe keyword in Rust. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I guess it should be obvious, like, don't, like, delete all the assignments when we drop one student. No easy solutions like that, please. But okay. So some last things about kind of coverage-guided fuzz testing. So something that I realized after going through Monday's slides is that I was kind of showing very synthetic examples. I like to emphasize that kind of, when we're doing this for security purposes, you know, typically we're not looking for like some condition became false. I use that for my examples because I think it's easiest to illustrate kind of test coverage and goals. But typically we're looking for like a crash or a bounds check failure or a stack canary check failure or something like that. And these are kind of things that will typically indicate a security problem. And fuzz testing is kind of better at finding these than finding normal bugs, because for normal bugs, we kind of have to figure out how to identify if the program's doing the right thing. For most security bugs, they turn into crashes in some cases. And you can think of it as kind of that a crash is just an exploit with a mistake. And that's what we'll find by accident. But there's a kind of a practical issue that not all of these will be exploitable. Not all of these will be security issues. And if your fuzz testing tool tells you here's a crazy input that causes a crash, it's often a lot of work to find out if it's actually something that's relevant security-wise. But this is a thing people do in industry. Like, there's some other things you have to make happen to make this sort of more practical to do in industry. People, you know, companies have used lots of compute time to do this, and you want to do lots of testing in parallel. So tools like AFL support, like not just like kind of we choose a random base test, they have like coordinating, you know, lots of cores and lots of machines running tests randomly and coordinating in a way that avoids duplication and uses a common set of base tests. And it's, you really want to run a lot of test cases. You know, like I kind of showed examples where it looked like we're running like, you know, 50, 100, but for a real program, we're going to have probably a more complicated input than like just two numbers. So we want to run like millions or hundreds of millions of tests or more than that. And so it pays off to like really optimize the performance of the test. And this often is something you'll do with knowledge of the program you're testing. So you'll like try to figure out how to make it so you can test the program without starting a new copy every time. Because you don't want to have all your tests start with 5 seconds of the 5 milliseconds of the program loading, because that's a whole lot less tests you can do in a second. Also, you want to like have your base tests, and this is going to be important on the fuzz testing side, like be things that are quick. You want that, you know, you want to start with fast tests. And in most cases, you don't need a big test to trigger a bug. Sometimes you do, and that's not great for fuzz testing because of the how many tests you can run to find that issue. And there's lots of heuristics that people use to speed this up. So one thing is that tools like AFL like try to, you know, sometimes try to figure out which base tests are more likely to be useful. And you can also kind of adjust your code and how you check that coverage to make it more useful. For example, something people have sometimes done is said, if we have a comparison function that like compares strings in 8-byte chunks, that's really hard for the coverage-based testing to realize, did we have an almost have a match? And so they'll like deliberately modify it to compare in smaller chunks so we have better coverage information that tells us if we're close to finding a new code path, for example. But in practice, like fuzz testing, the big reason why I'm covering it is in the real world, this is a very successful technique and it's relatively easy to pull off. If you have a program you need to figure out, you don't need to dump that program in Dihedra and analyze it for 20 hours to do fuzz testing. You set it up, you let it run on some machines, and very often it will find security bugs with relatively little effort on your part. I mentioned this idea that when we find things, it's lots of work to prove it's exploitable. And one kind of annoying issue when you sort of actually diagnose tests is that we can have duplicate test cases for the same bug. And this is very often a thing you'll find with fuzz testing, that we'll find, oh, I found 50 ways to crash your program. And you might think, great, it found 50 bugs. Probably didn't. So for example here, let's say this is a bug. This if statement that I've labeled D, that's a bug, like a crash. And in order to reach it, we have to run some part of the code above it. And there's a whole bunch of different ways of doing that. And very often, coverage-guided fuzzing will find a whole bunch of ways of reaching D. But if you're actually, you know, kind of figuring out what's wrong here, you as a software engineer are going to say, yeah, there's just one bug here. But it's going to say these are all different code paths, because remember when we're doing our coverage-guided testing, we're kind of measuring all the pieces of code that are reached, a set. I guess that matters. Because, you know, maybe it's the case that we need something in A or C to trigger the bug. You know, maybe because it's related to this condition here. But, you know, often there will, you know, it's, you know, as far as like fixing it, you don't actually want these extra cases, but the coverage-guided testing tool is going to give them to you. Some questions? Okay. And so, as I mentioned, there's a fuzz assignment that I think I have revised properly. I got them to install AFL++ on Portal, so that's an option, or it's one of the easier pieces of software to set up if you have a Linux system. Otherwise, and the assignment is basically I give you a program to use that on, and your job is to run it to find a few crashes and then look at those crashes and try to figure out, you know, what's their cause. What's the problem in the code that allowed that to happen? Okay, so we've talked about this kind of random testing, and our main topic for today is going to be a more systematic idea. So with random testing, we were kind of tracking what code was reached, but we were just ignoring why it was reached. We just like tried things until it happened. And you might say, well, what we really should do is we should just like figure out when is that if statement or whatever true. And there are implementations of this idea, and this is commonly symbolic execution is what it's called. That it's called symbolic execution because in concrete execution, we have concrete real values for variables and values in registers and so on in memory. And we just run the program manipulating those real concrete values. In symbolic execution, we have symbolic values that are represented in terms of variables. And we manipulate these symbolic versions. We do the algebra instead of actually doing like computations of specific values. And the idea of this is that we can do precisely what you might do by hand and say, well, if I have an if statement here, how do I get inside it? Well, I know that these two values we're comparing have values in terms of these variables. Let's solve to see when those variables are equal. And that's when we get there. And this is precisely what we do to do symbolic execution. So I'll start an example without any if statements. So what we might say here is that we're going to symbolically execute this function, and I have two values we're tracking, the A and B, and I'm going to represent their initial values, the ones we pass in, as alpha and beta. So at 0, A and B are alpha and beta, and we're going to execute this symbolically. So I'm going to do my first A plus equals B times 2. And I'm going to represent that effect on A and B just by manipulating my sort of things algebraically. So I'm going to say, well, this B times 2 is 2 times beta. Adding that to A gives me A plus 2 times beta. And so at 1, A has alpha plus 2 times beta. and B has beta, or again, alpha and beta represent kind of our original arguments. And then I can keep doing that. You know, so B times equals 4, that means instead of B being beta, B is 4 times beta. And then I can figure out what the return value is, and I can say, oh, it's alpha plus 6 times beta. And I can use this if I have some sort of equation-solving library, which, yes, very fortunately does exist and works surprisingly well, given that if you've taken DMT2, you know that it's actually impossible to write an equation-solving library that works all the time. But it works enough of the time that this is doable in many cases. So we can actually kind of enumerate solutions by solving the equation. We can just say, let's say I want to have this value be 10. I can like figure out a bunch of inputs to do that using that kind of algebraic thing. And I'm going to give some examples of actually doing this with anger, which is not actually intended primarily as a symbolic execution tool. It's intended for binary analysis, because one of the applications of symbolic execution is kind of reverse engineering. And you can kind of see how that might be the case, because from a reverse engineering perspective, if I do symbolic execution, I can say, not look at the code for this function, just have the symbolic executor run it and say, how do I make this be 10 for something else? What's an example that does that? It can answer queries like that. So that's a use for reverse engineering, though probably the place where symbolic execution has had the most success is sort of finding or preventing bugs, which is a different application. And anger, in fact, does symbolic execution on the machine code, which, as we'll talk about later, is probably not the form you want to do for finding bugs. You'll have better luck finding bugs with a tool that works on something closer to the original source code. And we'll talk about a very specific reason why later, related to pointers. But let's do an example here. So this is anger's a Python library, and it's written in Python. And so I'm loading a program that has our example function foo, and I find the address of foo. It's a binary analysis tool, so it reads the symbol table, you know, and I didn't like strip everything out here. And I get its address, and I make these variables that are 32-bit vectors called initial A and initial B. And then I say, give me the state as if I just called foo with the arguments A and B. And I guess for some context here, clarify, this is the equation solving library that comes with anger. So that's why I'm using that library for making the variables, because it's the equation solving library. You can actually use it independently of this to just solve equations. And I get this simulation manager that's going to sort of simulate the program execution. And when I print it out, it says with one active. So there's one active state. So as we'll talk about when we talk about how do we deal with an if statement, we need to kind of track that there's like two different possibilities. And the way symbolic execution tools will do this is that we'll track the state if we went down one path versus another. And if you're thinking, gosh, for a real program, there's a lot of paths. Doesn't that like, isn't that a problem? It really is. It's a big problem. And it's a reason why I talked about fuzz testing first. Because fuzz testing is much more practical, mainly because of that problem. And we can, for example, examine that state. And in this case, I see I made a problem here. there should be. How did I do that? Okay. So somehow I got my Python code with, I know how I did it, but with braces missing. But you can get the idea, I think. So here, I'm printing out sim manager, active state, 0. There's an array, and the value of the simulated RAP. So it's simulating the machine code, so we're tracking the values of all the registers. And you can see that when I set up the initial state, we have our simulated RAP, our simulated piece program counter, is set to the beginning of the function. And our simulated EAX is an unknown value, so it's left as this variable we don't know. And then I just step forward the simulation. And if I print out what the value of EAX is now, the return value, I see that it's represented as this value here, which is, this is a interesting way of writing A times 6 plus alpha plus 6 plus beta, or initial A being alpha, initial B being beta. So it kind of did the symbolic solving. And as you can see, I write things as nice algebra. This tool, because it's generic and it's dealing with bits and not logical values, it's a little hard to read and will get ugly. But I can say, okay, I would like to add this constraint that EAX has to be 10. And given that I do that, now tell me what's a possible value of A and B. And I say, oh, I really like B not to be 0. Okay, now what's a possible value? And it will find one. And obviously there's a whole bunch. This tool doesn't have a way of really enumerating them, but we can pull out values that meet the current constraints we've set up. Questions? Symbolic execution here. Okay. So let's do an example where we have if statements to illustrate what we do there. So here, you know, I'm again starting out with A is alpha, B is beta, and then I have if A doesn't equal 0, we do something. And the way we'll generally deal with this in symbolic execution is we'll kind of say, okay, we have this condition, so I'll kind of have two different states that I'll track going forward. I'll split the execution into two halves, and we'll deal with each half separate. And in the first half, I know A is not equal to 0, and also we changed A to be, sorry, alpha is not equal to 0, which was the original A. We changed A to now be the original A, alpha plus beta minus 2, and we changed B to be the original B, beta minus 2. In the false case, I know A is 0, or alpha is 0 and A is 0, and A is still alpha and B is still beta. And we'll just kind of recursively continue sort of our symbolic execution down one of these paths, and we can go back to the other one later. So let's say I go from the path where I went into 0, then I say, okay, now let's see if B is less than 5, so that's checking if beta minus 2 is less than 5, and I have my true case, where now I have this bigger list of constraints. And I can solve sort of all these equations to figure out how do I get to this thing labeled interesting. So questions on this? Okay. And I also would want to consider my other cases. So if it's not, I know I have the opposite constraints, and that doesn't get me. And I can kind of keep going from here and do that. And I'm going to do this kind of thing for all kind of the split cases. And so something you'll notice is that, you know, I can use, since I can like just query this solver to find what's a possible value of A and B, I can figure out how to make a test case for all of these paths. And this is kind of one of the early and probably still most prominent uses of symbolic execution, is that it lets me sort of more systematically generate test cases than our coverage by fuzz testing was doing. Where I can just say, here's the path I want to cover, give me a test case. So as an example here, this is again using anger. So I have my program with this function foo here. And when I tell anger to step through the states, I use this explore function, which says just keep stepping until you're done. And I tell it, by the way, please look for getting to this address that of the function interesting. So I run that, and then I look at what ways did it find, what states did it find that it ended calling the interesting function. And I just iterate through them and output a possible A and B value. And it's just solving the equations to do that. So questions on execution idea. Yeah. And I guess I don't need to, well, this is a similar example to what I showed for coverage guided fuzz testing, and we can do the same kind of thing. So this is the sign of systematic splitting of the states. So anger, which I'm showing you, works on machine code. This is great. Because it works on any existing application, it handles mixing programming languages very well, and anger is designed to, when we don't have anything that's a variable, we can use just normal emulation that might be like actually fast, because this is not. And also, because we're working on the machine code, like we can precisely define issues related to like uninitialized values and memory reuse and things like that. And so anger is like really designed for kind of the reverse engineering exploit side of it. So there's other tools, including CLI, which is probably the most prominent example from the research community, and it's like from 2008 and has been used to find like lots of actual bugs. Work on an intermediate representation. So a compiler like Clang or GCC typically produces an intermediate representation that then turns into assembly. And so CLI works on that form, that representation of code. So it's not like C code, but it's something which is closer to C code than assembly is. And that's more useful for reasons we'll talk about when we talk about how pointers work. Another thing is terminology-wise. You often people see things referring to concolic execution. You might wonder, what is that? And that's basically mixing symbolic and concrete execution. So anger's really a concolic execution tool because it can do that and does do that even when you maybe don't want it to. And so you'll often hear that term. That's just combining, emulating the code by like actually just doing what the instructions say on not variables and just values, and doing this kind of algebraic stuff, mixing that together. So let's talk a bit about give a preview of kind of dealing with pointers. And we'll look more about this issue later. So here I have my alpha, beta, and delta for the initial values of these two global variables, and c, and I have a pointer p. And I need to reason about like what happens when we dereference p. And so kind of a way we can do that is we can, you know, track what p is down our various paths. And so I realize that when we're in this path, p is the same as a, I need to track that, or this is the same as b. And then I can use that to figure out, okay, so after we do this p plus equals c, what is actually the possible values of a and b? And that's taking into account what, you know, p pointed to. And this is kind of a way we can deal with pointers when, you know, they have like one, you know, only a handful of possible values. We're going to have more trouble with the case where there's a lot of possible values for the pointer, like if it was like a pointer to the middle of an array. And let's do a little exercise here. So let's think about doing, you know, figuring out how this assertion is false. Can be false, and how do we solve for that? I guess I'll go over kind of, I have the work here for one. So for one, we've to do this, so let's say x starts out as alpha, y starts out as beta. Then this return says that that is equivalent to alpha greater than beta. So we know that alpha is not greater than beta. And we set x to x plus y, so x is alpha plus beta. And if I substitute that into this equation, we get alpha plus beta plus 1 is greater than beta. And if I just look at that naively, I think that's always true. We have an issue here, which is that this is really plus with overflow, with wraparound on overflow. And that is true in every single instance of plus. Yeah?
Does that mean that this is something that you could not solve purely symbolically?
Does this mean you cannot solve purely symbolically? No. It means that when we implement our plus operation in an equation solver, we need to take into account that this is really an unsigned integer addition that wraps around. And this is one of the reasons why this is, the equations are going to be nastier in practice than you might think. Right? So maybe the way I should write this is I will say that I'm going to write that alpha plus 32 beta, and like this is really alpha plus 32 beta. Something like that, like to indicate that this is not like just this is not the algebraic plus operator, this is the plus operator that, does an addition with truncation for an unsigned long, unsigned int. And this is indeed something that, so this is like one reason why like this might be less efficient, we get weirder equations than you might expect. So if you go back to my example here, you'll notice that it's kind of subtle, but this description here kind of deals with the overflow, how the overflow ends up working. Like it chooses a way that the overflow works, kind of explicitly by truncating the top of the value if there's overflow. So this is not, this doesn't mean you can't use symbolic execution to solve it. It means that implementing symbolic execution involves like not really, you're doing algebra, but you're doing your plus and minus and divide and times. Those are not necessarily the sort of operations you do in math class, or the operations that this like C compiler does. And it does matter that they're different, especially for cases like this. And we mentioned overflows are a common security bug, so we really want to get this right. So questions? Okay. So we gave kind of the introduction to symbolic execution, and there's kind of three big problems that we have. One is dealing with pointers is a problem. So I'm going to talk about that specifically. Another is that we have to solve these equations, and that's not always going to be possible. And to give a trivial example why it might not be possible, if I do that, we know that that's not tractable to figure out and then do, right, like if, like we know that that's not tractable to solve. Like, so there are things we definitely can't solve. It's kind of remarkable. It works kind of as often as it does, but for simpler cases we can do it, but there's clearly a limit. And it's gonna come up sometimes. And it's probably gonna come up in cases which are kind of less egregious than I'm calling a cryptographic function and expecting us to reverse a cryptographic function. But that's like enough to prove that clearly we're not going to solve things all the time. And the other issue is we can have a huge number of paths. A particular case where the number of paths might be really bad is if I have a for loop with a variable bound. The way we've been analyzing doing our execution, it seems like, I get like a path for each possible number of iterations. That's not great. There's some tricks we can do to like try to combine paths that are really the same or something like that. So there's ways of trying to deal with this, but it's still a problem even after a whole lot of heuristics to avoid sort of having too many paths. But let's talk about the symbolic memory problem here. How do we deal with this kind of case here? And one idea might be that we should have a separate path for each value of P and Q. And that's what we did before. We had that because we had an if statement, but we could simulate that. In this case, there are 10 possible values. Conveniently, it's only 10 because of this. If that wasn't there, it would be more than 10. So that means that we're going to explore 100 paths to figure out how this function executes. That's not something we want to do. So when we're dealing with pointer differences, then this is something we want to avoid. And Anger takes a particularly conservative strategy where they say, it's really bad to try to explore all the possibilities for a pointer. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to choose a set of specific addresses it could have. We're going to explore those, and we're going to ignore all the other ones. And yes, we're going to get the wrong answer. But that's okay, because we're going to complete the analysis most of the time rather than taking forever. But clearly, this is a big compromise, especially if we're thinking of consistently finding bugs. So Anger's default policy is for reads of memory, they just generate sort of a range of possibilities and choose one of them for writes. By default, for annotated values, they only take the maximum possible value, probably the maximum because that's most likely to trigger a security issue, but they don't actually check all the possibilities. Now, tools that work on those intermediate representations I told you about, they can do a lot better in this case because they're not dealing with machine code. They have a representation where we know what which was part of a struct or an array in C, and we can use that information to say this pointer points to this array and not some other array. In machine code, we know this pointer points to the heap or the stack, and that's about it. And so Klee's strategy, at least the original version, is that they track a list of memory objects it points to, which is usually not too big, could be. And their notion is that if the pointer goes out of bounds of a memory object for some reason, like the case here where we had this assertion would have failed if we didn't have it, they just say that's a bug, we should just tell you about the bug. For Anger, that's, for reverse engineering exploits, that's not really useful. And if it can point to multiple objects, we have a separate path for each object. And if that requires 100 extra paths, oops. So to give an example of sort of the consequences of Anger strategy and kind of the state explosion, let's look at, I have an example here. I have a function here. My first question is, I'm going to use this as an example, what are the possible return values of this function? And let's assume the array starts at some value, which is not some values. Someone give me one possible return value. Yeah. 0x30. Someone give me another. Yeah. 0x40. So the 0x30 is if x equals 0, y equals 0, 1 is one way of getting that. If x equals 0 and y equals 0, we'll have set slot 0 of the array to 1, 0, then set it to 2, 0, then add slot 0 of the array twice, getting 4, 0. And we really like our symbolic execution to be able to reason about this. It's not super simple, but it's a pretty simple function. Also, we have the cases I'll ignore of what if the value is out of bounds. We'll assume we keep it in bounds. And so let's say I ask Angry to do this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set my x and y to be 31 bits with a 0 at the beginning, so they're positive, which keeps some of the equation simpler. And then I'm going to tell Angry explicitly that x and y are between 0 or 1. So I do that, and I get one state, and it tells me, oh, it's all 4, 0. That's what the operator of the function is. And the problem here is that I mentioned that Anger's strategy for dealing with pointers is to use that approximation. And here, that approximation's getting me in trouble. It's not finding the 3, 0 output. And it doesn't find that even if I tell it to, memory. And what I can see is happening is that it's saying, oh, it has to be 1. It's setting them both to 1. And that's because Anger's default strategy for dealing with memory accesses that are writes was to just take the maximum possible value. So I can tell it not to do that. And it indeed finds that there's like two possibilities. It only finds actually one path, but it has the equation like take into account that there's two possibilities. So you can see it's telling me the return value is 0x20 plus something that varies depending on the inputs x and y. And basically it's saying, giving me an equation like this written out in a funny way. But you might see an issue with this form of the equation that it's tracking, which is that this is going to be pretty bad if I make my array bigger and make my constraints bigger. Also, I need to tell it if I want to let it have more than 128 bytes worth of possibilities, but I can do that. But not only is the equation a bit bigger, things run slower. Now, I'm running Anger probably not the most optimized way, so probably you can get these times down, but the big thing I wanted to point out is we have a bad trend. This should make you your senses on what is the big O here think, this is uncomfortable. That's kind of the reality of that. So another thing that seems like maybe an issue is how do we deal with IO? That turns out to have a relatively elegant solution. So basically what Anger and other tools do is they track files kind of as if they're arrays in memory with possibly symbolic values, and this is how we can deal with file input, app things. So for example, in Anger, I can say I have these variables, and that's my standard in. Just run the program. When it reads from standard in, have it read from that in your symbolic execution. The other thing Anger does related to this, that's an approximation, is that Anger will intercept library functions and have sort of summaries of them that aren't running the actual function code. So here we have this Python code, which importantly is just doing a single load and store in the simulation for the equations rather than actually running a loop. And this makes things a lot faster, but this is also a place where you can see that that when we have size being memcopy that's variable, they're not precisely emulating the program. And that's a choice they made. They just said it's too hard to actually compute it precisely. We're not going to bother. We're just going to take the maximum size and pretend you memcopy it. Because that's way faster than having this explosion of states for all the possible memcopy lengths. But I mentioned that you know, this is a tool like aimed at kind of the exploitation world, so I probably should show you like why do people think this is useful for exploitation. So with an example here, I load the executable from the over assignment, and I give a input that has 5,000 characters of variables, and I run it, and when I'm done, I say, okay, look for a state that was unconstrained, that had a weird location, and if that one appears to be have a program counter that is a variable, see if we can set that program counter to 0x12345678, and if you do, please print out what the standard in would be. And it outputs a standard in that will set the program counter to that. And you can kind of extend this to kind of automate exploits is the idea. It's not very efficient. Maybe, probably I could have a more efficient setup, but it's still like, it's CPU intense and memory intensive. But like this is kind of a big promise of the symbolic execution on this. So that's where we'll finish up today. So we'll finish up symbolic execution next time and probably start on sandboxing.